Hi, Mo.
Hey, Megan. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Maybe marginally less hot than you are, but...
marginally. Everything matters on the margin, right? We should introduce ourselves. I'm Megan McArdle. I am the Business and Economics Editor of The Atlantic.
And I'm Mo Tasik, the nothing right now but about to take a job as a staff writer at the Washington City Paper. So I'll be joining
Congratulations
Megan
on that.
Very soon in my hometown of big government Washington, D.C. Today we're going to talk about the economy and how to run it. I think it can be run. Maybe
I am skeptical.
You don't think it should be run. And possibly something called Aqua Buddha that neither of us knows much about. So that will probably be a short discussion. And maybe this, probably not the Paul Krugman, Paul Ryan debate, but why don't we get into... Oh, and then there's the question of Elizabeth Warren and her terribly controversial... possible nomination. So where would you like to begin?
I guess we can start with Elizabeth Warren, who I should say I think is a very nice lady. I've always enjoyed her on Dr. Phil, and I think she really, really cares about consumers. I still don't want her to be the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, but that does not mean that I bear her any personal animus.
Now, do you think that there should be a Consumer Financial Protection Agency?
I don't, for sort of odd reasons, I guess. There's this argument that you need to have a separate agency that just does this, because otherwise it will get lost in the mission of the other institutions. The thing is, I actually think that things like consumer protection, and indeed almost everything, should get the lost in the mission of larger institutions. And what I mean by that is this, that, like, any law that you propose, I was thinking about this last night with something requiring that television stations and everything do, all of their web video has to be closed captioned. And this is a critique that Philip Howard makes a lot, is that we have a long list in America of things that would be nice. And what we tend to do in America is turn things that would be nice into rights. And we give them their own separate authority.
Like public education?
In everything. In public education, in public accommodations, in what have you. We turn, everything from the Americans with Disabilities Act to the right of due process for your welfare benefits to the endless ability to sue over people trying to put anything anywhere near your house.
Sure. The problem with democracy is that people who receive benefits from the state can always vote to receive more benefits from the state.
And no, that's not my argument about this. My argument about this is that basically what we tend to do, and I think the Consumer Financial Protection Agency is a really good example of this, our instinct is we say, this would be a really good thing to have. And therefore, what we must do is set up some institution which can't be checked by other institutions, right? Which doesn't weigh its priorities against some other priorities. So that we don't want to weigh consumer financial protection against the interests of the bank. We want an institution that just does that. The problem with that is that what you rapidly get to is a situation where... we do have limited resources in society. There are always trade-offs, and you get into a situation where you can't make trade-offs because you have a bunch of institutions, each of which has their own institutional imperative. So, for example, Philip Howard talks about the ADA and how special education has become more and more expensive and is taking up more and more resources. Now, it's not to say that we're spending the wrong level of money on special education. However, because this is handled through the court system, it means that there's no recourse. There's no way for a school system to say, like, our special needs kids are important, but all the other kids are important too, and we have limited tax dollars. And so we have to weigh all of these priorities off against each other. You can't trade the special needs priorities against other things because a judge tells you how much you have to spend on each special needs kid. And that's a problem when, as we are now in our society, reaching kind of the limits of the government's ability to tax and regulate. It's getting more and more expensive to do each of these incremental things. And so when you set up institutions that are explicitly set up to be outside so that there is no weighing of trade-offs, there is no, we have to trade consumers against other consumers. For example, we may have to trade naive consumers, their interests against the interests of sophisticated consumers, or the interests of the banking system, the interests of the macroeconomy. That's, to me, problematic. I think it should have been in the Fed. And indeed, Elizabeth Warren thought it should have been in the Fed when she originally talked about it.
Okay, so there's a problem with the actual thing itself. Now, my general sense of these things is that, you know, we've got a lot of regulators out there. You know, there was sort of, you know, throughout the last 10, 15 years, there was a sort of choose-your-own-regulator ethos, where there was that was the protocol for these institutions, and now they want to create another regulator. I happen to think that probably if they had just been all along enforcing the laws that were already on the books, and if they had regulators, individual regulators in there that were interested in regulating, that we could have avoided a lot of the problems that we had. But, you know, what you got was Alan Greenspan and Dick Cheney basically running everything sort of undermining anyone who actually did want to enforce laws against, you know, fraud and, you know, people who wanted to enforce oversight of the banks. And so, you know, my sense is just that you have to get people in positions of authority who want to do their jobs. And that's why I'm pro Elizabeth Warren, because she seems to be a grown-up, and that's rare.
Well, now, I think that a couple of things. I'm not sure I would characterize Dick Cheney as having had a big hand in running the banking system. I think that the problem of regulator shopping
is
a big
not
one, but to me...
It.
But I don't think Dick Cheney actually had much of an agenda, a banking agenda either way. But I could be incorrect about that.
He met with Alan Greenspan every week in the White House, according to the book Angler. I have the sense that he didn't have his own agenda other than advance the interests of the wealthy and the powerful, of the already entrenched powerful, as much as possible, which he succeeded at doing.
I'm not sure that's fair. I mean, I'm not sure that, like, if you ask Dick Cheney under truth serum, that is, in fact, what he would narrate. Like, you can say that his ideology...
Do you think he's a reliable narrator?
Well, I don't think anyone's a reliable narrator. I think that most people are roughly equally self-interested and altruistic... in about the same measure as most other people. People, like, get things badly wrong, they may be unpleasant people, and so forth. I think certainly Dick Cheney was arrogant and unopen to alternate sources of information, and I think that, like, he got any number of things incredibly badly wrong. Do I think he was, like, a worse person who thought, like, how can I screw up America and benefit my rich friends? That seems unlikely to me. Most people don't think that way.
No, I don't actually think he thinks that way either. But I do think that there was a strain of conservatism that sort of developed during the kind of Great Society and the 70s that saw welfare and the welfare state as a threat and democracy, and the fact that people who received benefits from the state could always vote for more. And this is something that you'd hear from them. You know, I don't know if you saw Casino Jack, but, you know, in that movie, Tom DeLay basically says, yeah, well, you know, a dollar of money buys a dollar of access, you know. And the problem with that I see is that there's this asymmetry where, you know, there's only a certain amount of money that that it costs to win an election. There's only a certain amount of money that you can actually spend lobbying. So each lobbying dollar, you know, people sell out their congressional seats. for, you know, $1 million or $2, and they end up giving, you know, billions of dollars of tax breaks and, you know, and lucrative loopholes to corporations that can exploit them. So it's very, the incentive structure, as you might say, seems to me to be kind of permanently skewed.
Like I have some sense of how all of these things work, not certainly an exhaustive sense, but my take is that there's very limited amount that money buys access. It's absolutely true that people make campaign donations to the guys that they like, and that, like, you know, Barack Obama is more likely to pick up the phone for his one of his million dollar donors than for some random constituent. But money doesn't actually buy elections nearly as much as people think. It's actually, like, it helps. It absolutely helps, but it's not clear
how
much of that is money and how much of it is the fact
that the
incumbents tend to raise more money.
Right.
Well, incumbents tend to raise more money, and incumbents also have a massive advantage because they have free press, right? Every time your congressman goes and, like, cuts a ribbon somewhere, he gets free press, which is why, like, even millionaire candidates don't actually have that great a record.
Red tape with a chainsaw or whatever those guys did, although I don't think they were elected officials.
I mean, these things do influence elections, and my sense, just from being around Washington, is that these things do buy, like, little provisions, right? You can get, like, some little tax provision that just helps your one company. Although often that's because it employs people in a key district. It's not always because this guy's given a ton of money. It may be because he employs, you know, 20,000 of your constituents in a district that's hard to win normally. Like, there's just a bunch of, like, it's really complicated.
No,
so
I mean,
don't
I
think
agree.
That, like,
but I think that there's generally, you know, that we could use some sort of a wake-up call in among our elected officials, our public servants, just to tell them, you know, to get the idea out there that, hey, you shouldn't take as much money from these guys as you want. I don't fucking give a shit. Sorry, that's probably not allowed. But think about the payoff that this provision, this line item, this vote could potentially have for the wealthy and the powerful, corporate interests, you know, what have you, the already doing well. And maybe measure that against what you're getting out of it. And I think that there's, by and large, this sort of disconnect from the math of it in among our public officials. Because I've seen it time and again. You know, I don't know what the calculation was, that, you know, $1 in every bank, one bank lobbying dollar, you know, returned an ROI of 1,000-2,000% in some cases. And I also wonder, when we're discussing things like healthcare reform, sorry, I got another call that I'm going to have to ignore. That wasn't supposed to happen. All right, anyway, but I have another question about taxes, because I was reading on your blog that, that the definition of very rich seems increasingly to be set at just above the level a top-notch journalist in a two-earner couple could be expected to pull down.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think it's true. I think that, like, a lot of this stuff about how we should tax the very rich at some level is class interest on the part of pretty well-paid journalists. I mean, like, you know, people who write for The New Yorker, people who work for The New York Times, they're really well-paid relative to other journalists, but they're also really well-paid relative to most people in America who pull down, you know, average family income in the $60,000 to $80,000 range. And yes, it goes farther in Paducah than it does in New York, but it doesn't go so much farther that someone making $375,000 isn't really, really affluent. Especially because a lot of the stuff that they buy from Amazon or whatever is the same price that the guy from Paducah pays. Real estate and education are less, but lots of things are pretty much the same. And so, like, I always read these things, and I think, to what extent
food
is it that, like,
makes a big difference.
You know, I'm not rich, so obviously I shouldn't have to pay the tax rate. It's people like LeBron James. It's always someone who's comfortably much wealthier than you are.
Well, it's funny that you, I mean, that you choose LeBron James and not, you know, John Paulson. Or anyone.
Well, James Serbieski chose LeBron James.
James Serbieski, you know, and that to me seems to be a big con, because we always look at entertainers, but we never look at the people who are actually making the real money around here, entertainers and athletes. And, you know, like, and I just want to remind, I want to get this out there, because a lot of people don't seem to know this. The top 10% comprises people who make over $110,000 a year. Now, I make considerably less, and most journalists I know make considerably less. Certainly not top-notch, what I consider, and I have made more. But I make less than half of that, so I'm just putting that out there.
But, like, you're young, you're in your 20s, right?
I'm 31, you know, and I've been
had
jobs that in which I made more, but and I should also put out there that I could make more money if I chose to be in financial journalism, because the audience of financial journalism's eyeballs are considerably more lucrative to the media, and I have chosen.
Sorry, I have an importunate cat here who keeps. I'm staying with my sister. We're flooded out of our house.
And oh,
so
no.
I just have to tell people that when I'm smirking at the camera, it's not because I'm doing some sort of Al Franken on Mo. It's because the cat keeps jumping up on my lap and then, like, parading its tail across the screen.
I should tell you earlier I had part of a cigarette, and that was in honor of your libertarianism. And my imminent move to D.C., where they're about a pack of cigarettes here, is in Manhattan, is $15 now.
$15?
$15. Yeah.
Wow.
Yup. So,
Wow.
Yeah. So I'm doing my part. I'm contributing.
Well, you know, you're going to love D.C. then, where it's only half that.
Yeah.
Your cost of living is going to drop dramatically.
My cost of dying, too. The top 1%... is incomes above $398,000. Let's just put it at 4. And the top 0.01%, the top 0.01%, in 2007 anyway, made more than $11.5 million a year. Those people...
This is family income, by the way. This is not individual.
Right. It's household. The top... It's around 15,000 families, all of whom have a net worth over $100 million. Those people take in 6.04% of the national income every year. And that is, I think that makes a pretty good case. Since that's 6% of the wealth that we make in this country every year, why not give a separate tax bracket to that, you know, very small segment of the population, those 15,000 households, who happen to be taking in 6%, more than 6% of the annual GDP.
Well, I think that there is a couple reasons. Cat, really, honestly, go away. Stop it.
You're sorry. Your cat's a socialist.
This cat is, unfortunately, there's no way in my sister's house really to keep the cats away. It's all like open floor plan. And the cats really love, somehow they know, like all cats, when you're doing something, and they want to be part of it.
And they always want to, hang out on the keyboard, yeah.
Right,
do you have cats?
Yeah, this one's trying to hang out, like, it's going behind me, it's going in front of me, so apologize. Special cat edition of Blogging Heads.
That'll be sticky, I bet. The cat video.
It's not that I necessarily think that these people shouldn't have their own tax rate. There's just a couple of considerations for me. First of all, I have a sort of prior, which is that I don't think anyone should pay more than 50% of their income in taxes, period. I just think, like, that the point at which you're working for the government more than you is a problem. That's a problem for me. I understand that other people may not share that prior, but, like, I think a lot of people do, actually. I think a lot of people have the intuition that, like, you should get more out of your labors than the government does. Second thing that I would say
Sure, but so many of those people, I mean, how many of those wealthy households would, you know, really be where they are without a little help from the government? Whether it's
well,
in the
but
form
sure.
Of
I mean, which again, like, if the government's taking, if you're saying, like, look, there is a percentage of your income that you need to pay because that is the price of living in a high society, I'm good with that. I also support a progressive tax system. I think that people who are wealthier should pay a bigger percentage of their income. I just think that when it gets to 50%, I want to stop. That's enough. You have, like, the price of living in a free society is not that, like, that everyone else gets more of what you want to do. Second thing I would say is that practically, I guess what I'm saying is, like, I'm not particularly overwhelmed by the unfairness of someone who makes $1 million a year or $15 million a year, whatever it is, sharing a tax bracket with someone who makes $400,000 a year, because $400,000 a year is a lot of money. I mean, you can also say, oh, well, someone who makes $15 million a year doesn't make as much as Larry Ellison does.
I agree, but mathematically, it makes more sense to just focus on those 15,000, get some of theirs, because what are they doing with it, you know?
Well, it's harder to get.
They're buying planes.
The other problem is there are not that many of them, and it is harder to get their income. This is why,
yes,
for example, even Scandinavia has basically given up trying to levy the heaviest taxes on capital income. It isn't because they wouldn't like to. It is because you get big problems with capital flight. The wealthy are mobile. They can leave the country. They can decide that they have enough and they'd really rather not build another company, because why bother if you're going to take 90% of it, which is...
Why? I don't want any more hedge funds in this country. We have enough, right?
But it's not just hedge funds,
though. Shadow banks?
The wealthiest people in the
LLC.
It is true that, like, there's a lot of hedge fund wealth in those numbers, but the wealthiest people in the world are not hedge fund managers. The wealthiest people in the world started
Carlos
big companies
Slim.
That added, like, quite a lot of value. I mean, like, look at the top Forbes list. It's Bill Gates. It's Warren Buffett. It's, like, crazy people.
Sure,
people.
That's. I think that our perception, though, our society's tendency to correlate this idea of wealth in our heads with people like Buffett and Gates is incredibly destructive, because, like I said, there are 15,000 households out there, more than $100 million of net worth, a lot of billionaires in that population who you never hear about. And, you know, like those guys who were just charged by the SEC with insider trading, you know, people that you've never heard about, people who make their money primarily in, you know, controlling national resources, arbitrage.
I'm not saying, but in fact, like, I tried to make this argument that this was all, like, financial leech money. Mm-hmm. When I wrote a piece on Goldman Sachs and financial sector. And while it is absolutely true, there are a lot of hedge fund managers represented in these top, it's not true that it's, like, the overwhelming majority of them. There's not a lot of great data on it, but none of the data that I found backed up the notion that the majority of people in this super wealthy bracket are people who made it on financial transactions. There are a lot of professional athletes, movie stars, there's business owners of various sorts, not merely people who have
Oprah's
hedge funds, et cetera. There's some people who inherited it, like, not fair. I'm in favor, like, I have no particular ethical problem with estate taxes, although I think that there are a lot of efficiency problems with them. But, like, it's not, it isn't true that it's just, like, John Paulson. It would be nice if it was, because that would make it all ethically neat, but it, like, I have not found data that supported that. If someone can show it to me, I was looking for it. I wanted to make that point. I wanted to argue that, like, it was just all of this financial wealth that was driving America's income inequality, and I couldn't, like, the data, none of the data that I found backed that contention.
Well, there's oil wealth, there's property wealth, but the idea
but there's
is
also
that
a lot of wealth from people who build companies. Most of the people in, like, the, like, a slim, but nonetheless, a majority of the people who are in the Fortune or the Forbes, whatever, top 400 wealthiest people list, started off basically, like, with nothing resembling what they now have. You know, maybe there are some people who probably inherited a million and turned it into a billion.
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm not saying that they're all heiresses and that sort of thing.
As far as I can tell, it's productive company activity. Those are the, like, it is true. There are a lot of lawyers and hedge fund managers out there, but they do not, as far as I was able to determine, seem to make up even, like, a plurality. You know, they were in the, I can't remember their percentages now, I have to go back and look them up, but they were in the low enough that my argument, like, was not nearly as strong as I had expected it to be.
Under
25%.
Sure. But, what, you know, there's a difference between hedge fund manager and somebody who makes, you know, hedge fund managers are a subset of the larger group that I would say has made their wealth via primarily financial transactions. Now, that includes Warren Buffett, too. Why do we like Warren Buffett? Well, because he seems to be an ethical guy. He wants to give money away, and he's pro-raising taxes. So,
But he's invested in companies, and he's run them. Like, he doesn't, he's not just a financial, like,
no,
in some sense, he is, because
he
runs a
conglomerate. To stay out of the operations of his companies. That's why he sort of washed his hands, Pontius Pilate, like, of the Moody's malfeasance.
Well, but, like, he manages in a way that, like, I think most people, like, I've had this question for a long time about the financial crisis, about a lot of the 2001 stuff. I had this problem. Was my question has always been, where were the shareholders when things like Enron and when things like executive pay were going along? What were the shareholders doing? Why weren't they exercising oversight?
And the answer
I got from a bunch of fund managers was like, look, I don't have time for that. I don't get paid for it. It's better for me to sell out my position than to go in and try to actively manage a company that's not doing well. And so I think Warren Buffett actually, like, gets right in there and, like, he is an active shareholder. He does not invest in companies that do not behave well, that are not, like, engaging in good management. And, you know, like, he has Geico and so forth. I remember watching him stand on the podium and say, like, we do $100 million worth of advertising, and if I could figure out how to make it work, we'd do $2 million. You know, he really watches the operations of his companies and has stewardship over them in a way that most financial people don't.
So I'm not sure
I would put him in that class.
I wouldn't. There's, you know, and there's relatives. There's always relatives. And Buffett is. I'm just saying that Buffett seems to me to be an exceptional case. His own sort of thing. And the people who make their money primarily in financial transactions can be anyone, you know, from a cable empire that's managed to grow itself by a factor of 100 over the past 20 years. I mean, there's ways of making vast amounts of wealth via canny financial transactions. And I'm not saying there's anything inherently wrong with that, but what I'm saying is that we associate wealth with industries like technology, the information technology industry, for instance, that have, at the same time as they have enabled their entrepreneurs to amass vast amounts of wealth, have improved our lives in a way that's very palpable and obvious. And my only concern is that as all of that has happened, as we have associated wealth with Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, you know, I mean, the Foxconn, the little Foxconn suicide story was very interesting because it highlighted the fact that Apple employs, 10 Chinese for every American it employs. And Foxconn was producing its iPod or iPad contract. It had taken on that contract for zero margin. It was a sort of, you know, it was there's a lot of reasons that contract manufacturers might do that, but you know, there was a certain amount of prestige in it, and then there was the idea that, you know, who knows, they might be making knockoffs, you know. There are a lot of reasons that you might want to do that, but that's zero margin. And I think that Apple's gross margins are something around like 30%. And it highlights to me the problem that we have with, you know, thinking that the pursuit of profit margins, that corporate profits, that those go in the direction of economic growth, of job creation, that they all sort of, you know, go together, when in fact, you know, corporate profits are often amassed at, you know, at the expense of the taxpayer, at the expense of the average citizen, at the expense of workers.
I'm not sure I would agree that I think that that Apple amasses its profits at the expense of, I mean, other than people who pay somewhat inflated prices for its goods. I think that, like, I hear you saying, and I think I agree with it to some extent, like, there's a mythos on the right about who the rich people are, right? Mm-hmm. They're all these self-made entrepreneurs.
I don't think it's just on the right. I think that a lot of people have that.
But I think there's an equal mythos on the left. And again, like, I agree these positions can overlap. There are two sort of dueling mythoses, neither of which I think are correct, right? The one has that all of these, like, you know, Randian superstar entrepreneurs standing boldly astride the marketplace, creating all of this fabulous value for their customers. And then on the other hand, there's the belief that, like, the people who get rich or the people who get very rich or so forth are 99%, like, financial sharks who just shuffle paper around one way or the other. They may be CEO, they may be... And, like, I've done enough reporting on business to know how damn hard it is to be a CEO and how hard it is to grow a business. And I invite anyone who is sitting there rolling their eyes and telling themselves that I'm just an apologist for the wealthy to go start your own business, get some customers, grow it, keep your customers, deal with, like, all of the rest of it, and, you know, go out and play golf with people you do not like 8 hours a day in order to get their business, and do all of the other, like, I'm not saying they're, like, poor CEOs, but it's really difficult, and it's a skilled job, and everyone I know who's worked in venture capital and has their own money on the line thinks that it really, really matters whether you have a good CEO. But not just the CEOs, the sales guys and the finance guys, the operations managers, all the way down the line. Like, managing a company is, in fact, extremely skilled work that's hard to do, and when you have bad managers, you can get very bad results. So I think that there's some truth to that.
I definitely agree with you there, in that, you know, there's a tendency among, and it's way worse on, it's pretty bad on the left, to think that they're all sharks, they're all criminals, they're all the same. And, you know, I mean, the financial crisis, Citi was, required $45 billion in bailouts. You know, AIG was just a complete disaster. And meanwhile, you know, J.P. Morgan came out on top. There's like a considerable, there's a $50 billion difference in, you know, that's very quantifiable in the competence of CEOs and management in amongst, you know, institutions that were in the same business. So,
although in the case of AIG, I actually think that, like, again, only I will say this is a qualified opinion, what appears to me to have happened. And it's distressing how much of this all seems still murky, you know, 2 years after.
I think it
was a rogue group, and that, like, the CEO doesn't appear to have even had any tools to evaluate, because, like, the stuff was so opaque that the risk managers didn't really get it either. The only people who got it were the people who were trading it, and they were grotesquely mistaken. And so, although they did start getting out in 2006, so, like, the management eventually did recognize what they had done.
Well, sure, yeah. I mean,
But it took a long time, because the only people who were really in a position to understand what they had done were the people who were making these grotesque mistakes.
There were the people who were asking them to make them as well. I mean, there was a lot of, you know, there when when the synthetic CDO was created and when there started to be this incredible boom in synthetic CDO business around the beginning of 2005, I think I read in Institutional Investor or something like that, you know, somebody said, well, you know, no one's quite sure how much we should be paying for credit default swaps, but everyone who's buying them up right now seems to be thinking they're getting a pretty good deal. And, that was just, that could be a whole conversation in and of itself, I think.
Yes.
And it was definitely, you know, I agree with you, not, you know, representational of the AIG business, although I also think that it wasn't some other ways, I'm just agreeing with you that there are large differences, within the same industry.
But I guess I think in the end, to bring this back to taxes, that it's hard to know, like, there's never going to be any sort of reasonable way to assess, like, is this human being adding value to society or not? We can sit around and argue about it forever and ever, but ultimately, like, it's not something that you're ever going to get some sort of, like, societal consensus on. I mean, Bernie Madoff, we can all pretty much agree, didn't. But short of that, it gets harder to tell, and I'm not sure I want the government saying it anyway. And so I think that what you end up with is cash cutoffs, and I think, to me, how I want to make those cutoffs is not whether someone who earns $15 million in some iconic sense deserves it. It's what's the highest we're willing to let tax rates go? And to me, that's like a little under
50%. And you want to take it back to Reagan-era 50%.
Under 50%. I think total state and local income taxes should be...
49.9.
No, 45. Total state and local, though. So, like, yeah, for federal, I think the Clinton tax rates, along with the Medicaid, Medicare surtaxes and so forth, are pushing the line of what I'm comfortable with, because in districts like New York, they really are pushing the effective marginal tax rate over 50%. Although then with financial people, they're taking a lot of capital gains. I have a lot of arguments about what we should do to the tax code, which would take us the rest of, starting with eliminating the corporate income tax and then taxing capital gains as ordinary income.
Do you think that the tax code could be a lot simpler, but then we'd put the accounting industry out of business?
And yes, and thank God. I think we should eliminate the corporate income tax just because, like, the number of people who are smart and could be better employed doing something besides telling corporations how to avoid their taxes. Like, put them out of business and do it on the individual side when, first of all, half of the tax sheltering industry in this country, right, is just moving stuff from ordinary income to capital gains or dividends or tax
remunities
or whatever it is. Like, get rid of that. Just tax everything at the same rate. That's... not possible.
But I don't think it's going to happen. Yeah.
No, I don't think that this is going to happen either. But I think that, like, the fact of the marginal tax rate, the top marginal tax rate, should be combined state and local and federal should be leaving, I'm going to leave out property and sales tax or whatever, but combined state, local, and federal, the top marginal rate should be under 50%. Maybe not hugely under 50%, but under 50%. And that then, you go back and say, who can afford to lose what? And the thing about Warren Buffett, and the reason Warren Buffett should pay a higher tax rate than his secretary, is not that I really care whether Warren Buffett makes more money than his secretary. For me, the reason that he should pay a higher tax rate is that when you take 25% of his secretary's income, she has to cut back on a lot of consumption. When you take 25% of Warren Buffett's income, like, the utility loss from the consumption he can't do is just smaller. The utility loss from not being able to take a vacation at all is much larger than the utility loss between, like, getting to go to an awesome $50,000 a day villa on a remote island somewhere and having to pig it at a $1,000 a day luxury hotel room in Hawaii. Like, that utility loss does not interest me. And so the question is just, at what rate do we say
the utility loss
doesn't interest
me? Well, here's the thing. I mean, now you're a libertarian. So, or you identify as a libertarian, although I would call you a sort of, libertarian with Chinese characteristics or something like that.
I'm a squish. I'm a libertarian squish. It's probably the best way to...
Okay. Now, we have a drug war in this country because at some point we decided that that was one kind of economic activity that we did not think was good, that we did not want in our GDP figures. it seems to me to be rather arbitrary when you have, you know, companies like Purdue Pharmaceuticals in Connecticut making, you know, still making $2 billion a year on OxyContin sales. But, you know, there you go. Do you think that that is basically a bad idea, that just no sort of economic activity should be considered more equal than other economic activity? Are you anti-drug war?
Oh, I'm definitely anti-drug. Like, I think we should legalize it all. Now, I should say Mark Klevin, who is a liberal and is very, very smart, knows more about drug policy than I am, disagrees with me on this and really thinks that, like, she thinks grow your own for marijuana, but he's in. I think it should all be legal. I understand this probably would mean higher rates of drug addiction. I have not drunk the libertarian Kool-Aid that far. But I also think that it would mean lower rates of social pathologies surrounding the drug addiction. And that, like, I have a whole bunch of sort of, I don't think it's right that the middle class protects itself from drug addiction by creating these horrific conditions in poor areas that already have quite enough problems. And I think that, from a liberty perspective, people should have the opportunity to become addicted to drugs if they make that decision. They're adults, they're not children. But, I mean, like, I don't think, but I'm not sure how much legalizing the drug war would generate in terms of economic activity, because it turns out that, like, the street price is grotesquely inflated. So if you could tax the street price of cocaine, it'd be awesome. You'd make all of this tax revenue. But if you tax, like, the actual market value of this stuff for labs that buy it, it's like $10 an ounce to buy lab-grade cocaine.
You would also definitely legally. Take... I mean, I think that the NRA has to be opposed to the legalization of drugs, you know. I mean, you take a lot of...
They think about it, actually. Their position is. The thing about the NRA is they're coalitional with both conservatives and with libertarians, so I would suspect they haven't taken a position on it for just that reason. Because libertarians are all basically anti-drug war. I don't know of any pro-drug war libertarians. There may be one out there, but I've never met that person.
That's how they get you. That's how they get you, people.
That's right. They're the first ones free. I was talking to someone last night, and he was like, you know, the weird thing about all you libertarians is that, like, none of you do that many drugs. And this is not entirely true. I do know some libertarians who do a lot of drugs, but he's actually right. Most of us are like...
You were going to say that you do a lot of drugs.
No, I'm afraid I don't. I have a day job.
What's the coolest drug you ever did?